All right, wonderful. And good morning, Nathan, also. All right, well, I'm going to go ahead and call this meeting of the TRPA Local Government and Housing Committee, also known as the LGHC, to order. The date is Wednesday, January 6th, 2021. Happy New Year, everybody. And the time is 9:32. So we're obviously having a virtual meeting today. I'll be going over the unique virtual meeting rules in just a moment, but first we want to have a roll call to determine a quorum of our committee. Catherine, will you please call the roll?
My pleasure, Ms. Gustafson.
I am here. Happy New Year.
Good morning.
Ms. Aldine.
Here.
Ms. Hill.
Here.
Mr. Lawrence?
Here.
Mr. Rice?
Here.
Ms. Faustinos?
Here.
Ms. Novosel?
Here.
Mr. Friedrich?
I wonder if he is a panelist. Let me look and see.
Attendee, maybe? Just double check that.
I don't see him on the list.
I don't see him on either. Okay, well, hopefully he'll join us soon.
Madam Chair, we do have a quorum.
Thank you, Catherine. Okay, so now I'm going to review quickly our virtual meeting rules for the day. To observe and participate in the meeting, please go to trpa.org under announcements in the center of the page. Click on Listen Live, Government, Local Government and Housing Committee, for January 6, 2021, online meeting. Members of the public can find all meeting materials under documents, and the tab is meetings and notices, other meeting materials, January 6, 2021, Local Government and Housing Committee meeting. In order to provide public comment during agenda item 3B and item 4, 5, excuse me, please utilize the hand-raising function in the Zoom platform at the appropriate agenda item. With your hand raised, you will be unmuted by TRPA staff and have 3 minutes to address the Local Government and Housing Committee. You can either click Raise Hand, or you can join us on your computer, tablet, or smartphone, or you can dial *9 if you've called in. During the workshop in agenda item 3, you may ask a question using either the question box or by using the hand-raising function. To the LGHC members, if you wish to speak, please alert me via the chat function if you are online, or just speak up and wave your hands. Please make sure you send your chat message to panelists only. Committee members may only use the chat function to indicate desire to speak. This function must not be used to have a sidebar conversation. And finally, everyone remember to mute your mics unless speaking to cut down the noise back on the background. I also request you turn off your camera during the presentation portions of the agenda items 3A and 3B. Pursuant to open meeting law, this meeting is being recorded and the recording will be posted to the TRPA website after adjournment. Okay. So on to the next item, which is approval of the agenda. We are on agenda item 2, the approval of the agenda. Are there any committee members or staff, there's any changes to the agenda? Give everybody a second here. If you have any changes, please let me know. Okay. I don't see any. John, Hester, are there any changes?
No changes, Madam Chairman.
Thank you. Okay, then I'm going to deem the agenda approved as posted. On to item 3, planning matters. That brings us to the presentation by Optico's Design on diversifying housing choices. You can find this information on page 1 of your packet. And I'm going to pass this along to Karen Fink to introduce Optico's consultant to present. Staff will turn it back to me when this item is done. Thank you. Karen?
Thank you. Thank you very much, Sue.
Thank you.
We're very excited to have Tony Perez here from Opticos Design, and I'm going to give him a chance to share his screen. So I'm going to stop sharing so that he can share his screen. And Tony, let me know if you have any issues with that. And then while he's doing that, I'm going to go ahead and give a little background on the presentation and talk about how it fits in with the work that the housing work that TRPA is engaged in with our partners. So just by way of background, one of the ways that TRPA is addressing housing issues with our partners is through the Tahoe Living Working Group, which is a committee of the APC, and it provides support to the local government and housing committee and the governing board in their decision making related to housing. The goal of this group is really to find ways to meet the regional housing need by putting the pieces together at the regional level so that local jurisdictions can then adopt the plans that help them meet workforce housing at the local level. So this working group has put together a set of priority recommendations that they want to start moving into development in February. Those recommendations are going to be the subject of the agenda item that comes after this presentation that the local government and housing committee will be considering. And one of those recommendations is to revisit our density regulations in town centers and multifamily zones. So that's why we asked Tony to present today to share some of the experience that his firm has had working with other communities as they look at similar regulations. That will help lay the groundwork as we start getting into this issue more over the next several months. So some of the things that you're going to hear about in the presentation are things that can be done at the local level, and some can be done at the regional level. And some of the concepts are already starting to appear in local codes. For instance, the City of South Lake Tahoe is bringing some objective design standards forward to their council later this month, and you'll see some of these concepts starting to be addressed there. Some of you may have seen a similar presentation in North Shore that Opticos gave last year. So if you're here again today, we appreciate you joining us again. And now I'd like to go ahead and introduce Tony. So Tony is a senior associate at Opticos Design, which is an architecture and urban design firm. And he's worked with over 45 communities of all different sizes on revising their zoning codes. And he's also had experience in the public sector, and he teaches urban design and planning to graduate and undergraduate students. So we're very excited to have Tony here. Thank you. Tony's presentation is about 45 minutes long, and then we'll have a Q&A afterwards. And Alyssa Bettinger will moderate the Q&A. Alyssa Bettinger from TRPA will moderate the Q&A. So, Tony, do you want to go? Were you able to share your screen?
Yeah, it should be shared right now. Are you seeing it?
I do not see it.
If you want to just go ahead and share, try sharing it again. We saw it for a second, and then it went away.
There we go. Sorry. There we go. How about now?
Yep. Now we can see.
So go ahead.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Karen. Thank you, everyone, for attending today. Thank you for giving your time this morning to talk about this and to listen to our experience and recommendations. It's a real privilege to speak to you. I'm from Northern California, even though I live in Southern California. Don't hold that against me. I'm from the Sacramento River Delta. I grew up in Isleton. And I came to college down here in Southern California and met my wife and did what Northern Californians say they'll never do. I live in Southern California. So anyway, I am not an expert on Tahoe at all, but I'm an expert on missing middle housing and on form-based codes and zoning codes. and zoning standards and objective standards. And so that's what I'm going to be talking about today. So the focus on today's missing middle housing. So why is it important? For the majority of the 20th century, communities saw the centers of their communities, what we now call walkable places. You've heard that term probably in some way. What we now call walkable places were actually becoming vacant in the 20th century. People were leaving them. They were going away from them and building out in the suburbs, building farther and farther away from the centers of cities. In the latter half of the 20th century, that started to reverse. And the 21st century, that's what it's all about. People are realizing they can't, either for the conserving agriculture or nature, or because they can't afford to extend out into nowhere any longer, people are coming back to the cities and back to walkable places of all kinds of sizes. And there's a lot of research on this, and several groups are corroborating this. You can see a couple statistics here that basically people, not everyone, of course, but a majority of people are increasingly seeing the value in walkable places. And walkable places, we'll talk about that quite a lot today, but they come in all different shapes and sizes. But unfortunately, most of the attention, the early attention on walkable places was at this scale. So if you talk to people in cities, they say, yeah, this is what a walkable place is like. It is, but it's not the only version. And here's a local version in South Lake Tahoe. And I'm sure you're all familiar with it. And this is the kind of walkable place that I'm talking about today. When we talk about missing middle housing and neighborhood scaled walkable places, this is the kind of place we're talking about. It certainly can include this, but this is at one end of the spectrum, and the other end of the spectrum is here. And so that's what, when you hear me talk about walkable places today, this is what I'm referring to. Along with that, there's an increasing trend across the country that we're seeing that, you know, these are the three choices essentially people are given in terms of housing choices, either the detached single-family house, which they may or may not be able to afford or want. And then the townhouse, which is an attached single family house in most cases, or the apartment flat. And sometimes they're big six story buildings like this, or they're two or three story buildings, but they're bigger apartment projects. And so some people don't want to live in them, and some people don't want those buildings as neighbors. And so these three choices are prevalent across the country in terms of what people are offered, but increasingly we're finding that the choices out there that people want are a little more subtle. So baby boomers, and I'm one of them, I'm right in that 55 to 64 band of age. Increasingly baby boomers are starting to say, hey, we've got a house and the kids are out of the house, we're empty nesters, let's reconsider where we're living. Maybe we have too big of a house, we need something smaller. And so that's certainly happening. The other end of the spectrum is our kids. my daughter is 23. She's right at this band of millennials, but she's thinking like this. There are two-thirds of them that are saying, you know, I don't want that house that I grew up in. I don't want to maintain the yard. I don't want to live too far away from the action. I want to be closer to things. So that's happening. And the other big demographic trend that we're seeing across the country is that a third of households are actually single person households. It's quite a change from the 50s and the 60s and the 70s. So the big question here is if you're planning your housing with this in mind, and most communities that we talk to are not, they're still thinking about households that are larger. And certainly there are a lot of households that are larger, but the point here is that about a third of them, according to the U.S. Census Bureau, are actually single-person households. So what's missing middle housing? It's really important to think of this as a band in a spectrum here. You can see the diagram that Karen was showing at the beginning of this meeting. This is a diagram that Dan Perolik in our office created, 12, 13 years ago now, through the observation that, you know, there are houses, and then there are, at the other end of the spectrum, the mid-rise or the larger apartment buildings or the Main Street buildings. And then in between, up until the 40s, about the 40s, there used to be all these other things that were just being built in neighborhoods, duplexes, fourplexes, courtyards, all these other things. And for a variety of reasons, the zoning outlawed them or made it very difficult to make these happen. So we'll talk about that. But basically, missing middle housing, the way to say it to somebody, we figured out the most concise way to say it to another person if they have 8 seconds to tell you and to listen. It's house scale buildings with multiple units in walkable neighborhoods. So that walkable place is part of it. So let's break that down. I want to walk through examples of missing middle housing out in real places. And on the top of the slide, you're going to see the name of the missing middle type, in this case, duplex, side by side. And on the right-hand top, you're going to see the range of density of units per acre. And so for those of you that aren't familiar with density, density is a numerical standard that that has been in many city zoning codes and general plans, and is a way of controlling how much gets built on each lot. But the sad fact is that it was really a technique to understand how much could be built over big areas of land, you know, over 50, 60 years ago when they first started really using this technique across the country. It was a way to forecast what was needed, how many people would be in a certain place, and to try and prevent overcrowding, which was something that was happening in the early 20s in New York and places like that. So this tool that was originally meant to try and help forecast has now found itself in all the zoning codes of at least cities in California and general plans, and has become this metric. And so people have, as you might be aware, they have pretty intense conversations about that number. So that's why I'm taking a while to explain it here. It's certainly important, but as you're going to see, it's not the most important thing to be talking about. And at the bottom right of each of these slides, you'll see the size of the lot that is on the slide, and then some other sizes that could also work for that building type. So this duplex side by side, that's the first one I'm going to show you of 9 types. And the important thing to note here is that I think duplex for a lot of communities has come to mean 2 big single family houses glued together with a lot line in between. And that's not what the duplex side by side was originally meant to be. All of these buildings that I'm going to show you are what we call house scale. So if you think of the biggest house in town as the biggest one of these could be, then that's it. But it never was, you know, more than one house put together with another. So this one is intended to be in the size of one house with 2 units side by side. Then the cousin of that is the duplex stacked. So instead of side by side, this is a duplex with 1 unit on top and 1 unit on the bottom. You can see here, this is a street full of them in a beautiful neighborhood in Los Angeles. You can see the stair on the right-hand side in the middle of the screen going to the top unit, and each of the units is a flat. And then it's important to note here, you know, with the side-by-side, the building footprint is a little wider. You can see that, like from one end of the building to the other across that porch. And look at this one. It's a little narrower. So all these considerations are things that you need to take into account when you're writing standards for all these different types. So that's the duplex stack. And then there's the cottage court, where it's small individual units arranged around a garden or a court like this, with maybe one building in the back that has 2 or 3 units. And this is a really, you know, a lot of these types that I'm showing you, they were originally intended for people that didn't have enough money to buy a house, a big house on a detached lot. and or they were new to an area and they were just trying to rent a small apartment. And so these were different choices of how to do that. And the cottage court is really popular down here in Southern California. Here's one in Pasadena, beautiful example. It's bigger, obviously. But even though it looks grand, those units aren't that big. I think these are probably 600-700 square foot, maybe 800 square foot units at the most. One story around this garden with a couple units in the back there in that two-story building. And then there's this one. This is the triplex fourplex. So this is actually in Greenville, South Carolina, where we worked last year. I was driving with their client down this neighborhood of just beautiful single-family houses, huge ones. And I said, hey, whoa, stop. Let's look at this one. And it turned out to be a fourplex. I thought it was another big mansion like the rest of them, but it's actually four units. And you can see here the density range at the top. And then this is one that really struck me. I was in Coeur d'Alene, Idaho, giving a talk on missing middle housing last year. And similarly, driving around with the staff, and I said, wow, look at this big single family house. If you know, you could redesign it. And they said, no, that's actually a fiveplex. So this is what in missing middle talk we call the multiplex, or a mansion is another name for it. But that is not a house. That's a five-unit multiplex. And then at the other end of the spectrum, here's a multiplex in the Bay Area. Just to show you this, we'll talk about it more, but this idea of density. Okay, so this one has five units, right? This one has six units, whole different architecture, granted, and everything else, and a smaller footprint. But look at the density number, 82 to the acre. And on the bottom right there, you can see I provided some other sizes of lots that could make this building work with the size of the building that you're looking at on the screen, and what the density would be if you did that. And then the townhouse, there are two varieties of townhouses. There's what we call the large, where the buildings are 2 to 3 stories tall. There are usually more than four in a run, or in order left to right, arranged side by side. And so this is the large. And then here's the small, where it's no more than two stories, and it's usually 3 to 4 in a run or side by side. So you can see here left to right, if you look closely, there are four doors there. But the whole building, see how it's detached from the next one? You know, if you look quickly down the street and say, oh, that's one building, it's one house. And then you look closer and you say the different addresses. So the idea here is that this has certain places in a community where it would make sense, and this has certain places where it would make sense. And then at the top end of the spectrum of the missing middle types is the courtyard, where there's always the courtyard around which the units are facing. And sometimes the courtyard is deeper and larger, and sometimes it's, you know, like this, just very modest in size. And you can see the difference in the lot sizes there on the bottom right. When you look at this presentation later, you can look at all those different lot sizes. That this is the lot sizes we're showing reflect two things. One, the lot size that is on the screen, and the lot size, another lot size that will work for this building type. And then in some cases, you'll see here, let me go to one. I've tried to put, let's see here. Yeah, so for the duplex, I know that this will fit on the 50 by 100 lots that you all have. I looked at some areas recently with Karen, there are a lot of 50 by 100 foot lots, and so these types of work there. These other types, you can arrange properties to result in that much land. Sometimes the depths that you have of the 100 feet are a little limiting. So this one could work if you put two lots together. And then lastly, the carriage house is the other missing middle type here. And, it's basically the unit attached to the side or the top of a garage in the back or along the side of a unit with a house. And the density here, you know, basically take whatever the density is of the log and double it by half because you have a second unit. But this, there are a lot of different ways to do ADUs, accessory dwelling units, but this particular way is called a carriage house. And so here's a quick summary of a quick look at your multifamily density of 15 units per acre maximum right now and your town center density of 25 units per acre max, and a quick summary of what the types that I showed you, which of them are allowed, and which of them might be allowed or not allowed based on those densities. And you can see that the multifamily density of 15 units per acre doesn't really allow a lot of them. It allows some of them. The townhouse density works for more of them, but there are limitations as well as there. But anyway, that is working better, the town center density. Okay, so where do you find these types? These are some of the best examples I've seen across the country. This is Louisville, Kentucky, but it's very typical of what we see across the country. We find these in neighborhoods. We aren't taking credit for inventing missing middle. We are just simply trying to say, hey, this is something that was working for communities as a way to vary their housing choices and housing types in neighborhoods of all kinds across the country. It was just happening. And then after World War II and the focus on single family housing, it went away. And so here is a great example in Louisville, Kentucky of on the right hand side of the screen, you'll see there, those are single family mansions with fourplexes and eightplexes right next to them in the same form as the mansions. And then just a couple examples here from different cities. This is Pasadena. That's a fourplex on the left, the cottage court top right, and a fourplex on the bottom right. Coeur d'Alene, there's that mansion that I showed earlier, that five-unit mansion, townhouses on the top right, and a fourplex here on the bottom. And, I want to really emphasize, this is not about architecture. It's about building size and how these buildings relate to the street and how they set a pattern of what looks like house scale buildings just happen to have more than one unit in them. And here's in Greenville, South Carolina. And then here are a couple examples from the Tahoe area. So Karen made me aware of this 12 unit building here on the left. So we would call that a multiplex large, a larger version of the mansion. And it's right at that top end of the spectrum. Then we found a fourplex and a duplex here. So where do you find it that, we found that there are four general patterns of how these building types either already exist in communities or communities work to make it happen. And so one way is just to allow them in existing neighborhoods through the zoning rules. And you can see that the buildings that are gray and white, those are houses that are already existing. And the yellow buildings with the brown roofs, those are the new missing middle types being inserted into that neighborhood over time by their owners. The second strategy is to say, hey, let's leave all the houses on the neighborhood alone and let them have accessory dwelling units. You can see them in the back of those lots. But then where the arrows are pointing, let's allow that on the, what we call the end grain of a single family block. Let's allow those lots to change because it might be on a busier end of the block. Or maybe there's a busier street going by there. And maybe that's where we can put missing middle types and leave the neighborhoods alone. Or maybe there's already the need for some higher intensity multifamily along that corridor on the right of side of the screen. And as a transition to the houses, let's allow the first lot or the second lot away from the corridor. You see that alley there. Let me see if I can point it there on the screen right here. These two lots, some distance, maybe one lot or two lot. Let's let those get missing middle types and leave the rest of the neighborhood alone. or a similar strategy of maybe there's a neighborhood main street here and on the busy street, and going down into the neighborhood, you can transition from the main street to the neighborhood with these missing middle types. What we found here actually across the country is that this is a very, very real situation. You've got these buildings here on the main street, and then right here you have a house, and all of a sudden this house, because it's so close to this main street, often gets the pressure to redevelop, but the zoning doesn't let it happen. And so we found that this is a good strategy to consider, that either that first lot or that second lot is allowed to become a missing middle type. And that way it doesn't come into a commercial building and extend the commercial into the neighborhood. So what are the important characteristics here that need to be considered? Again, you know, we really make the point that this is not another way to do medium density housing, because that's a whole other thing. So, you know, you remember I said that missing middle is house scale buildings with multiple units in walkable neighborhoods. Walkable neighborhoods meaning walkable places. So it might be a main street area, a small main street area. It might be a moderate intensity neighborhood, a higher intensity neighborhood, as long as it's walkable. So what makes walkable? So you see this map. This is a map we did in our work in South Carolina that shows all the centers in this community. And the blue dashed line around each of them is about a 5 to 8 minute walk. And so what we worked with the community there is we said, hey, all the lots that are within about a 5 to 8 minute walk, it's reasonable that those lots are within walking distance of these centers. And if you start thinking of centers as an amenity, and you have the biggest amenity already, the lake, the mountains, and the nature, but in terms of neighborhood amenities, if you start thinking of all these centers as amenities of different kinds, and you look at the lots that were then about a 5 to 8 or 10 minute walk of that, then that right away tells you the type of the areas where you can start to really consider allowing missing middle housing. And that's different from parking missing middle housing, let's say, way out here in this area where there isn't any center to walk to, and you're just going to be making people drive further to go get services or go get shopping or whatever they're doing. So this is how we promote missing middle housing, that it's part and parcel of a walkable place. Secondly, as I said, these buildings are all house scale. If you take the biggest house that you would like in your town, if you haven't defined that, then that's a way to start here and take from the smallest cottage that you saw me show earlier and go to the largest house that you would consider in your town to be house scale. That is a range of house scale in your town. And that's going to tell you a lot about the footprint, which most zoning codes don't consider. They consider bulk, they consider height, they consider all these other things, but they don't consider, well, how wide can that footprint be? And so that's how you get there. But it has to look like a house, not just architecturally, but in its footprint and size. And then the other important characteristic of missing middle is that it's simple construction. It's stick wood frame construction. Because it's two stories. Sometimes, like you see in the left side of the screen here, this is a project we're doing in Nebraska for a multifamily developer, a former multifamily developer who said, I don't want to do multifamily anymore, I want to do missing middle. And so this developer is building two stories, or in this case, this is what we call a 2.5-story house, because the attic is occupied. So there's a partial third floor up in that attic, but from the street, it looks like a two-story house with a pitch roof. And then the other big characteristic of missing middle is that the units are hovering around 1,000 square foot average. And sometimes, you know, there are 400 square foot units in there, there's 600, there's 800, maybe there's a 12, maybe there's a 1,400. Rarely do you find units that are in 2,000 or bigger. You certainly can do that. But the idea of this approach is to make their demand on parking, make their demand on area, all of those things less by making the square footages smaller and also making them more affordable by doing that. You know, because let me talk about this for a second. The problem with the density approach to regulation that we found is that if you tell a developer this is the maximum number of units that you can get because of the density, they're gonna build the largest units that they can because they have a limited number, and so if they have a limited number, wouldn't you get bigger so you could sell them for more? This approach says no. Let's see how many you can fit into that building based on the building footprint and based on other characteristics. And if you design them right, why shouldn't you get more? The other characteristic along with this is that parking is less, and parking is critical. It's super local. Nobody wants to take anybody's advice from anywhere else. I hate to tell you, one of the big Achilles, not Achilles heel, but a real critical point in all these considerations is certainly parking. And this is an analysis that colleagues of ours did while we were working on a project in Austin, Texas a few years ago. And they did this analysis about the impact of adding parking to projects. And basically, you can see at the bottom, going from one space to two per unit actually adds about 30% to the income required to keep that affordable. And we could talk about this for 2 hours by itself, but I'll just suffice it to say that parking is super local. Parking needs to be certainly worked out. But the second that you start adding, like if you apply a very suburban approach to this idea of missing middle housing, you're going to make the projects bigger than they need to be, and the lots are going to need to be bigger than they need to be, and the neighbors are going to say it's too big and all these other things, and starts to become something else. And that's why we are so, we advocate so strongly that this idea be connected to walkable places that don't have the same parking demands as a suburban neighborhood does. And then the barriers. You know, people say, well, this sounds interesting, but what about this and what about that? And so that's what we found. There are a lot of barriers. Some of them are obvious and some are not. In the work that we did in Greenville, South Carolina, we did some work in Idaho Falls last year as well. And right now we're working in a couple other communities across the country doing what we call a missing middle scan. And what this showed in those communities is that their zoning standards, you'll see on the left there, it says zero units in yellow. Well, this zone technically allows 20 units to the acre, and it's a multifamily zone. But when we applied the site setback standards to a 60-foot wide infill lot, it rendered the lot useless. And we pointed this out to the agency, and they said, wow, you know, no wonder we don't get anybody coming in to try to do multifamily on infill lots. So it was either an attempt to prevent multifamily, or it was more likely the latter of applying a 25-foot setback to a big property of a couple of acres. It makes a lot of sense, but it doesn't make any sense on an infill lot. So you can see on the right-hand side, we said, okay, well, regardless of the current rules, what would fit there? You know, let's just say that you could rewrite the rules in 2 seconds. What would fit there nicely? And so we showed how a multiplex, one of those mansions with 5 units in it, would fit and still be within the 20 units an acre maximum allowed density. And so let's talk about density for a couple minutes here. The building on the left has 49 units in it and is a couple hundred feet long, it's like 175 feet long. The building on the right has 5 units, and it's one of those mansion fiveplexes. It's about 37 feet long, 38 feet long, something like that. But numerically, look at the bottom of the screen, they're almost the exact same density. The building on the left is 30 and the building on the right is 29. but they could be more different. And yet communities have long drawn out battles and spend lots of time and resources trying to arrive at the right number. And we have found that there is no right number. And so let me continue and I'll give you a recommendation, but this is just an observation that we've seen over and over again. So let's take this fourplex that I showed earlier. Most of the time, I mean, I would say I've never met anybody that I've shown this building to that says, wow, I can't stand that building. It's a beautiful fourplex by the Green and Green brothers, the architects that worked in Pasadena quite a lot. And so this lot is 60 by 170. It has 4 units on it, and it mathematically comes out to 17 to the acre. When the Green and Green brothers designed this, the density wasn't limited. This is what they designed it for. So we're just calculating the density now after the fact. But let's take that same building and let's add 5 feet. You see in this middle scenario, let's add 5 feet to the lot width and make it 65 feet wide. What does that do? It drops the density by 1 unit per acre to 16. Let's subtract 5 feet. And now there's less lot width, and now it's 55 feet wide, and the number jumps to 19. So this building can go from 16 to 19 to the acre, and yet it doesn't change. And 5 feet is almost imperceivable. It's a little wider than this hedge here that we're talking about, and yet the density goes up and down. And there's all kinds of different examples you can look at about that. And so the other big character or a metric that communities use is floor area ratio. So let me explain this very quickly. Briefly, floor area ratio is another tool like density that was derived early on in zoning practice, where whoever is making the rules says, let's say it's 1.0 floor area ratio is allowed. That means for the entire lot area, you get the same amount of square footage coverage. So if you have a 10,000 square foot lot, you get 10,000 square feet of coverage, and then minus setbacks, of course. So that's how it's intended to be used. And then it's a simple calculation. So somebody says, oh, I have 10,000 square feet. I can stack it up into 3 stories, or I can stack it up into 4 stories. I can stack it in 1 story. You know, there's all kinds of different ways to do it. So floor area ratio is the amount of building relative to the amount of lot. So on the left here, you see the stacked duplex in that neighborhood I showed earlier, and its floor area ratio is 0.67, and it has front setbacks, side setbacks, and rear setbacks. But look at this building on the right, a 24-unit, 3-story apartment building that is completely different than the 2-story duplex, and yet its floor area ratio is lower, 0.63. So if we assume that lower is better, you would be saying that the 3-story building on the right is a better fit than the 2-story building on the left for a neighborhood. And depending on the neighborhood, that might work. But most neighborhoods, the building on the right is not going to be a good fit. That's a big apartment building that is a different category of everything that we've been talking about. So our point here is simply to say that density and floor area ratio are very prevalent tools that communities use. And we're just saying that they're very limited in what they can do and need to be taken into context of how much they should really be driving discussion and driving regulation, because the predictability that they offer is very low. And a couple last examples here. So a couple of mixed use buildings in town centers in Marin County, where we're currently working on objective standards. The building on the left is totally loved. People totally identify with it. It's the Blue Rock Hotel, probably 100 years old at least, 25 units. And look at the density, 121 to the acre. The one on the right is in San Anselmo, and it has 2 units in it, has 22. So the building on the left would not be allowed anywhere in by your zoning standards, but the building on the right would. I think it's also interesting, though, that if somebody said, you know what, today those two units aren't enough to make that work with the cost of construction and everything else, so I want to put a third unit in there. The calculation for that means that the density would jump to 30, I think 32 I calculated. So it wouldn't be allowed by your current 25 maximum in your town center standards. And for the one on the left to be allowed in your current density of 25 to the acre in town centers, it would have to come down to 5 units. And so that building, I don't know that somebody would build a 5-unit building with 3 stories. It would probably be a 2-story building. So again, there's a relationship between the form and the intensity of buildings that really needs to be there. And so what we found, our experience is that the floor area ratio and the density tools, although very interesting and helpful, are often very limiting in ways that don't really benefit the outcomes. And then other things that we ask you to consider is to stop using, in terms of barriers, to stop using multifamily as a term, especially for missing middle housing, because as you're going to see, it's really not multifamily as we know it. And also, as soon as you say that, for opponents and for a lot of people that are concerned about neighborhood character and scale and compatibility, whether you intend it or not, for a lot of people, this is what they think you're talking about. So we talk about housing choices. And then it's important to understand, here is an aerial of St. Helena in the Napa area. It's important to understand when you're writing rules and redoing zoning standards that all the buildings that we're talking about, and every building that you can think of, falls into basically 2 categories. It's either block scale, like the buildings on the left, which are individually as large as a block, or attached together, what forms most or all of a block. So they look like they're covering an entire block or most of it, individually or collectively. And then buildings on the right in the purple, those are what we're talking about with missing middle. Those are house scale. And so they're detached. They have setbacks. They have medium to small footprints. They can be a couple different stories, you know, maybe 1, maybe 3, but they're house scale. And whether it's a small church or it's a big house with 6 units in it, that's a different scale and different footprint than the buildings on the left. So knowing this is super helpful when you write rules. And that all boils down to that everything we've been talking about really points to the fact that missing middle is not single family and it's not multifamily as we know it. And that's why it takes special attention to understand what missing middle is and is not, so that you can actually write rules that don't mess up the multifamily world for the people that are doing that work, and don't confuse a single family world with all that. It really merits its own consideration and own standards. So who's building this? We're doing a project right now in Nebraska, like I mentioned, and these are the building types that developer has chosen to build. It's super interesting that developer said to us, I've been doing buildings with corridors and lobbies and all these other things, and I don't want to do that anymore. I want to do buildings that are walk-up and don't have elevators and don't have any corridors. And the reason he didn't want to do corridors is that he couldn't really lease that. It's what, you know, it's what he called non-leasable area. And so he wanted to maximize the amount of area that he actually could lease, and very smart. And so these missing middle types, since they're all walk-up, they do that. And then this is a project in South Jordan, Utah. It's a version of the townhouse, but it's a cousin of it, really. So we designed this project, and it's going really well. It's one of their best performing housing choices in that entire community. You can see here the different housing choices on this table, and on the left and the bottom, The developer told us that this particular Muse townhome was actually getting the highest return in terms of, or highest sale price per square foot for the attached housing. So what can you, this is the last section here, what can you do to enable missing middle housing? And I don't want to read all these to you. There are 11 of these, what I've been told, hacks. I grew up with the term hack meaning not very good. Like that person's a hack. That means they're not very good at that. But I was told by planners that zoning hack meant like tips. So this list is intended as a list of tips that we've found over and over are really places to start. So I'll just take 10 seconds here and you can read through them or glance at them. And then they're certainly here on the recording. Okay, and certainly we have time for questions afterwards, so I'm certainly welcome to take questions on any of this. And a couple of examples of getting started. So in South Bend, Indiana, about 2 years ago, we worked there on something like this, and the community there as a first step said, well, you know, just give us some direction on how to analyze our existing lots and what they can do, what they can actually accommodate on these different types. And so we gave them some directions, some things to look for, and worked with them. And they did this analysis. And so you can see the different types of lots sizes that they looked at, and they coordinated them with the different missing middle types that would fit on those lots. And they were able to understand how their zoning could be tweaked or needed to be replaced or just, you know, changes. And then, of course, there's this other technique that we've done for communities where we do a scan or a deep dive, and we actually show very clearly what your zoning is doing and what it needs to do to actually use those lots for missing middle housing. And then lastly, I think one of the most effective techniques that we've found is pilot projects. Oftentimes after a talk like this, communities are interested and developers are interested, and maybe even the neighbors are interested, but they're hesitant to start making changes. And so one of the ways that we found that really works for those kinds of situations is for a developer who's interested and the community and the neighbors to say, hey, there's that vacant parcel down there, or there's that parcel that project's being proposed on, but what if we did a missing middle project? And we just found a way, like the plan development permit, for example, to arrive at a missing middle project on that property without changing the rules yet. And whatever we find that works on that property is going to inform how we're going to change the rules later. So we found that across the country to be working very nicely. So that's my talk, and I'm ready for questions. And thank you for your patience and listening.
Thank you, Tony. That was great. If you have questions for Tony, please raise your hand if you are a local government and housing committee member, and we'll call on you. And if you are an attendee, you can feel free to put your question in the Q&A box at the bottom bar on your Zoom screen. And with that, I have a couple questions that I would like to kick off. You did mention parking, Tony, but in Tahoe, I think we have sort of a unique situation because of the snow in the winter, so there's not a whole lot of on-street parking during the winter. So wondering if a lot of these photos that you showed in your presentation, it looked like there wasn't parking, or maybe it was just sort of hidden in the back. So wondering if you can kind of speak to how you deal, or how you've seen other communities deal with the issue of parking. And if you have any recommendations for us.
Yeah, absolutely. As I mentioned to you, everything comes down to parking. It just does. So what we found Well, first of all, in snow country, we found sometimes communities can work with their public works departments to allow parking on one side, but that can be problematic. So that set aside, what we found is that parking for these types is in the 1 to 1.25 parking spaces per unit range, sometimes up to 1.5. But once you get past that, as I was mentioning, you start to get a parking lot that is bigger than the lot you're working with. And it can't work. So that's why it has to really stay around one space per unit, or I would say up to 1.5 the most, just because of size alone. You know, a lot of zoning codes, because of their requirements, have actually caused, across the country, have caused this project to eat its neighbor, if you will, to tear down the neighbor to get more open space or produce more parking, and that isn't necessarily a good pattern either. So the balance we found is between 1 and 1.5 spaces per unit maximum. And yeah, they were in the back and down the side, to answer your question on location.
Great, thank you. It looks like Jim Lawrence has his hand raised, so I will unmute you, Jim.
Hey, good morning. Thank you, Alyssa. And, thank you, Tony. That was a great presentation. Really appreciated it. It actually had me reflecting back to my college days in Eugene, Oregon, where it seemed like everybody I knew rented a duplex because every corner lot was a duplex in Eugene. And then I moved to Northern Nevada and I was like, where's all the duplexes? I thought it was great, extremely important topic. You know, one of the struggles we have at Tahoe is that, you know, there is development caps for environmental reasons that are embedded in the regional plan. And for the most part, it's sort of seen that Tahoe is already developed and redevelopment is really the key to the future, as opposed to having an abundance of vacant lots to start building these projects. And we're really talking about redevelopment. And I'm wondering if you had any thoughts or experience with that, you know, working with different communities, you know, what are some of the better tools in more of a redevelopment situation as opposed to a vacant land situation, or is there a difference? Maybe it doesn't matter one way or the other.
No. Actually, you know, my presentation today and on our office's approach to this is primarily redevelopment, or what we call infill. When I said infill, I was talking about redevelopment. Yeah. You know, we do work on some greenfield projects, but that is a rare exception. What we advocate for is that, instead of communities adding on to themselves, either because they can't or they don't want to for environmental reasons or traffic reasons, that they reconsider how they're using certain areas. And that's why that map about the walkable places is so important. Once you start looking at your area like that, it's going to start to really help you hone in on which areas geographically make sense to consider. I want to be careful to not imply to everyone here that map is all of a sudden becomes your missing middle map and you go rezone those properties. You could do that, but that's not what we're saying. We're saying that's where you start looking. And Dan likes to use the term, Dan Perolik in our office likes to use the term missing middle ready. So if you go back to that slide, you'll see that term. And I think that's an approach that we found helpful, is that you're not talking, you know, some communities like, or states like Oregon and Minneapolis, the city of Minneapolis, they're looking at, well, let's just get away from single family housing and all that. That's not what we're saying. We're saying that this is a strategy that used to be a part of neighborhoods. And so go look at the areas that could accommodate this type of development where development already exists. So maybe there's a gas station or something, or there's a duplex that could become a sixplex, you know, that kind of consideration. I don't mean to go into single family neighborhoods and change them.
Thanks, Ty. That's helpful. Appreciate that.
Yeah. Thanks for the question.
Thanks, Jim. Another question about affordable housing subsidies. Curious, Tony, about your experience with these types of developments, are they usually market rate, or have you seen affordable housing tax credits go towards these types of developments, or is it generally that higher level?
Yes, great question. We usually have a slide in here about, and you'll see it in Dan's book, The Missing Middle Housing, but there's a diagram they put together that shows subsidies on the left and increasing supply on the right. In the middle is the missing middle diagram. And that's our position, is that missing middle can use subsidies, but it tends to not. The people that we see building it and developing it, it turns into market rate very quickly, because people say, wow, I didn't have that choice, and that's a nice little fourplex to live in. I want to go live in that. I want to go buy or rent that unit. And so it's a double-edged sword. On one hand, you have the housing choices being made available. On the other hand, they become market rate very quickly because of their very presence and absence in the current market. So our experience has been that the subsidies are not very prevalent in this approach, but it doesn't mean that you couldn't use them, of course.
Great. And then another question about ADA requirements. And I think this is probably more related to those types of developments that are stacked instead of right next to each other. Or have you seen any limitations with having to provide for ADA requirements, or you could speak to that as well?
Yeah, so the ground floors of multi-unit buildings are usually the ADA units. Because the law doesn't make you make every unit accessible. But once you have an elevator, that changes. So these buildings are non-elevator buildings. And so what we found is making the ground floor units accessible, zero grade entry, that kind of thing, then that works. The second you make it an elevator building, and everything changes. So I just want to differentiate this from multifamily apartments that way.
All right, looking through the Q&A box. Currently in Tahoe, we already have lots of mega mansions that have already been built. Some of them will no longer be able to be used as VHRs soon, vacation home rentals, which was their original purpose. Have you had success getting people to convert these huge homes into 2 to 4 units? And if you have any experience with this, it would be great to hear.
Yeah, I think that we haven't seen a lot of that. It depends on the area. Like you all are in an area where that's a real big issue. So I would say that those kinds of buildings that are already set up as individual units are perfect for conversion, because you're not having to put it in a new kitchen, a new restroom. They're already built that way. And that's another thing to not get lost here, is if you look at the missing middle buildings that we're advocating and we're building, they're the same as the ones in the 40s and the 20s, in the sense that they always were individual units. They always had their individual restroom, maybe a kitchenette, maybe a bigger kitchen, but they were never just, I want to differentiate this from the fraternity house syndrome, where, it's as many people as you can fit. That's not what we're talking about. The vacation home rental actually is it's easy to convert because their individual units are already designed that way. But the other issue with a vacation home rental is whether it really is one of these things, or is it just some giant building that happens to have individual units in it? So what I hear you saying is it sounds like it is, but I don't know that without looking at it.
And Alexis, I want to give you the opportunity. I see that you have your camera on and wasn't sure if you had a question. Nope. Okay. Let's see. We did get a question in the beginning about TRPA's density focus and how that relates to our growth management system, through the development rates that we have available. And I think that this is sort of an important distinction to make, that TRPA's development rate system is limits the amount of growth that can happen, but the density really limits where that growth can take place. So when we talk about increasing density, we're really looking at the areas that are already zoned for multifamily or within our town centers. So it wouldn't be expanding the number of units that are still available in our growth management system. It would just be concentrating those in an area where we want them.
Yeah, that's good. And I think that another thing to consider there is that very few communities have the problem. Well, let me put it positively. Very few communities actually achieve the amount of allowed density on the properties the way that the general plan says that they're allowed. Let's say a community says 12 units to the acre maximum. Most communities have the problem. Somebody said, well, that's great. You're allowing me 12, but I'm building at 8 because what I build, my production of what I build and sell is at 9. All of a sudden, you multiply that lack of 3 units per acre achievement over all the other properties, and communities are finding themselves short of housing because of that. So that's one thing. The other thing is to look at where you're allowing certain densities and ask yourself the question, is that going to be achieved there? And if it isn't, should we allow some to be achieved somewhere else and either take the limit off or, because the other thing is you can do it by density units per acre, but you can also do it by not regulating density the same way and just regulating number of units. It's more work, but it's more accurate.
All right, it looks like Shelly has a question. Shelly, you are unmuted.
Thank you. Nice presentation, Tony, thank you. I have a couple of questions. You know, we're dealing with kind of a new and unusual dynamic, and I'm just wondering how the pandemic has affected housing choices when people are forced oftentimes to quarantine for long periods of time. I mean, I can only imagine how difficult it is for people living in small apartments to confine themselves to an apartment for months on end. And I'm wondering if that's going to change or increase the desirability of larger units and maybe even result in a kind of a rebounding of the market for single family homes.
Yeah, it's certainly a real concern right now. I think that what we're seeing talking to developers across the country in different communities is that while that's a very real concern, it's seen by most people as probably a temporary concern and not necessarily something that's going to last into the following years that would permanently affect multifamily. However, there probably is a segment of the population that would be permanently affected in their thinking about needing bigger units or a single family house. That you know is certainly out there. But our experience is that is a fraction of the population. So again, we're
okay. Next question on a percentage basis. How many of these new missing middle housing types are for sale and how many are for rent? Because I think people are of the opinion that if you have a vested interest in a unit, whether it be a townhome unit, you know, a condominiumized apartment unit, that you're more likely to take better care of it. You know, it's an investment you've made, for the foreseeable future. Have you found that there is less resistance from, let's say, adjacent single family neighborhoods if these units, which are smaller and oftentimes more, you know, on smaller lots and more dense, that there's less resistance if they're actually owned by the occupants as opposed to rented by the occupants?
Yeah, I think that's generally true. Although I can go down my street here and show you people that are on their house that aren't taking care of it the way the neighbors think they should be taking care of it. So it's ownership is not doesn't universally result in higher or better maintenance, but generally that expectation is true that people say, oh, it's going to be for ownership. okay, my resistance is different now. They might still resist it. It just would be different. But yeah, I think that that's the case.
And also, have you found that there's less resistance to the idea of using accessory dwelling units as rentals than coming into a single-family neighborhood that's traditionally been used for that purpose and changing the zoning to accommodate a new type of housing form?
You know, it depends on the neighborhood. I think it totally depends. I can give you examples at both ends of that spectrum. If you're talking about the peninsula in the Bay Area, you know, San Carlos and Mountain View and those kinds of places, San Mateo, they're super worried about a house, let alone an ADU. But in other areas where reinvestment is being really sought after, it's a different conversation. It's actually people are excited to be coming in and seeing, wow, there's that fourplex going down the street, that duplex coming in. It's better than, you know, what we had. Or so it just depends on the perspective I can't give you a universal answer, but there are answers across that spectrum, and it just depends on where you are.
Okay, well, I appreciate that. And one last question. We've received as members of the committee emails from folks who think that the solution to workforce housing in the Tahoe Basin is to basically put a damper on short-term rentals. And I guess this is a comment for TRPA staff and a question for you. I'm not sure of the total number of STRs in the Tahoe Basin, how many are actually rented full-time as opposed to being rented part-time and then part-time used by the actual owners of those houses. And that would be a useful statistic to have, because the assertion that somehow we're going to solve workforce housing by eliminating STRs, I think is kind of a fallacious argument. But what has been your experience in other communities, and I'm sure that communities around the country, around the world, are having similar issues with short-term rentals and their impacts on neighborhoods and communities. But have you found that STRs are a deterrent to the development of missing middle housing?
No, they're two different conversations. They're two different topics. Short-term rentals are, you know, they speak to the desirability of your place. They, you know, hey, I can own a unit in Tahoe and not live there and feel like I'm part of the community and feel like a local and not have to rent a hotel for a bunch of money and have a local connection, as opposed to workforce housing and or a missing middle housing, which is I want to live there, you know, and I don't want to rent there all the time. And I may rent my missing middle unit, but I'm not a short-term tenant. So they're two different conversations, but they're not mutually exclusive.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for your questions.
Thank you, Shelley. Another question about parcel size. There tends to be smaller parcels in Tahoe, and parcel consolidation is not very common to create, you know, those larger courtyard projects that you showed in your presentation. Do you have a sense of what percentage of a parcel would need to be developed in terms of land coverage in order to accommodate these housing types?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, yeah, great question. So just taking, again, you know, I'm not an expert in Tahoe, but I looked at the South Tahoe area that I showed the map very early in the presentation, and those lots were all 50 by 100. And so the duplex, both varieties of the duplex work on those. The fourplex could work with some, you know, some creativity, but in order to get more than the fourplex on the 50 by 100 foot lot, you'd have to combine another lot to get a little wider lot. And so I'm not here advocating for that. Actually, the opposite is what we do. What we advocate for is that you work with the existing lot patterns you have, because too many zoning codes enable something, but what you really have to do is go buy more property to do that. And that just makes you tear down your neighbor, and it makes for more speculation. It says, oh, Alyssa, you own that house to the right of me. Guess what? you know, I have to buy that property to make my project work. And everybody knows that, and it actually freezes things. So you want to be very careful to not make your standards require parcel assembly. So my answer to the South Tahoe area is that only pick the types that work on lots that are 50 by 100 and allow projects to be wider than that, but make the standards work for the lots that are there. And in terms of lot coverage, sorry, that was the second part. Lot coverage, what we found is that the lot coverage in most zoning codes is more than you need for these types. That's, again, back to the house scale. House scale is like 36, 38, 40 feet wide by 60 feet deep. Depending on the lot width, sometimes it's 50 to 60 feet wide by 60 feet deep. They're usually not bigger than that, often 40 by 40. And what we find is that the lot coverage in most zoning codes lets those buildings cover more of the lot. So what happens is there might not be that many units on it, but the neighbor says, man, that building's huge, and it's only two stories. So back to footprint. So the footprint of missing middle types is always less, typically less than what city zoning codes allow in lot coverage.
Thank you. One more question about parking. There's quite a few examples in the Bay Area of developments where they use the first floor as indoor parking. I'd imagine that would be quite expensive, but can you speak to that at all? Is that a good thing to do, a bad thing to do?
Yeah, so the thing with parking is, if you notice the pictures that I showed, what was being shown was the building and the ground floor and the sidewalk. In some cases, there's no sidewalk, but the front yard. And that ground floor relationship between the unit and you walking by is a lot of times a big deterrent for people. If it's negative, it's like, oh, it's just a parking lot, ground floor is nothing. It's like that multifamily building I showed as a negative example. That's what people start thinking of that area. And they say, oh, is that what you're making? No, thanks. We're not going to do that. But the second you start to be more creative with parking and put it down the side or in the back, and I know that you have snow, so it's harder and the driveways are expensive. But the main thing is you don't want it glued onto the front if you can help it. You want to put it down the side, maybe behind the first 30 feet of the building. If you're going to put it inside the building and on the ground floor, put it behind the first 30 feet, because 30 feet is a good depth of a unit. And from the street, you'd say, oh, there's a unit, I don't see the parking. But you go behind it, and the parking is there behind it, and now you can put units on top of that, or behind it.
Great, thank you. I think this is actually a really great question. When someone builds a fourplex or another type of missing middle housing, does the contractor or developer typically own the building and rent it out and rent each unit out? Or do you oftentimes see that they will just sell the whole building?
Yeah, great question. In Nebraska, that project is, I think it's 600 units on, I want to say, 40 acres in a new neighborhood. It's called Prairie Queen in Papillon, Nebraska. And that developer chose to own them all and to rent them all. He's a multifamily developer, although he says that's not what he does anymore. He's still an apartment builder. And so he owns the whole thing. We've seen all kinds of things. We've seen people build a pocket neighborhood and sell the houses individually, fee simple, or a condo. We've seen people condo, a sixplex, a fourplex. But one of the barriers is above four units, then that's when usually requirements come in terms of commercial loans, the parcel map, condo map, and then it just requires a lot more sophistication or patience on the part of the builder of whether to own or rent. But so there's all those kinds of considerations, which is why often the fourplex and the duplex are what communities go after, because it's just so much easier for everyone. You're not going to that's the other thing is those of you that you know are policymakers or maybe investment encouragers, and you talk to developers, the big developers probably won't go for this because they have their models and they have their certain amounts that they need to build and the way they manage those properties. And maybe in 20 years that'll change, but right now it's we find that the majority of developers looking at this are smaller developers that might have previously been building houses, and they're used to building houses. Now they're just building houses with a couple of units, you know. So and then the last part of your question, ownership or rental, we found out everything. We found some builders that say, I want to hold on to them, like the Nebraska one. Some that say, here's a duplex, I can sell it and move on. So it just depends.
Great, thank you. I think we are going to wrap it up. Tony, thank you so much. That was a very informative presentation and great questions. I'm going to hand it over to Karen to talk about next steps.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much, Tony. And thanks everyone for attending and for all your excellent questions. There are some more questions in the chat that we weren't able to get to. So Tony's going to put together a memo that looks at some of the specific issues related to Tahoe after this, and we'll try to get to some of those questions if we can. And then a couple of people asked if the session is going to be recorded for viewing later, and it will be. So we'll post a link on our website. Thanks. If there's no final comment, I don't know if you want to make any final closing comments, Tony. I really appreciate your time.
I just want to say thank you very much to all of you for letting us talk to you and share our experience with you, and for being interested in it. So thank you. Have a great week.
Cool. Thank you.
Now, Karen, or do I stay on?
You're welcome to stay on if you want, or you can go off. We're going to go to the next agenda items now, and I'm actually going to turn it back to Sue to take us to the next agenda item and give me a chance to share the presentation screen again.
Thank you, Karen. And I just want to say thank you, Tony. That was a great presentation, very exciting, gives us some great options. And for us policymakers, you know, the direction is there. It's great to see that it's working in other areas, and hopefully we can start to work on these things. So thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you, everybody. Have a good day.
Bye. Great, you too. Thank you. Okay, so with that, we're going to move on to item number 3B. It's a discussion and direction on the priority housing actions for further development by the Tahoe Living Housing and Community Revitalization Working Group. Information for this can be found on page 3 of your packet. And with that, I'm going to pass this on to Karen, and we're going to discuss, maybe we can put some of these things we just saw into action. It's very exciting. Karen?
Great. Thank you. So thanks, Sue. So now we're going to talk about the priority housing action recommendations that the working group developed at the end of last year, and that they want to start moving forward into further development starting in February. And I just want to point out kind of this item today is still really high level. We're talking about what are the overarching actions that the working group is recommending moving forward with, whereas Tony's presentation was much more detailed. And so we will be getting to those details a little bit later, but today we're still at the high level. So we'll go through the process and explain how the working group arrived at these recommendations. And then at the end of the presentation, we have a slide that shows kind of a summary of the recommendations, and we'll ask for the local government and housing committee's feedback at that time, and a motion to recommend that or a modified version to the governing board. So the Tahoe Living Working Group is a direct outcome of the housing action plan that the local government and housing committee approved in November of 2019. And this Tahoe Living initiative has become part of the TRPA's operations work plan for 2021. So the working group first met in August, and the purpose of that meeting was really to confirm the overall housing need that the group is working towards, and to confirm a process for identifying the key actions where TRPA can really add the most value to the work that local governments are already doing to meet their workforce housing needs. And to assist with that, we presented two tools. One is the action catalog and the other is the housing cost analysis tool. So the action catalog, that was a compilation of all of the housing actions that our partners had already developed through their own work. So the Tahoe Prosperity Center had worked on a housing action plan for the South Shore. Mountain Housing Council had been doing some in-depth housing recommendations. The local jurisdictions have housing actions identified in their general plans. And some of TRPA's previous work had identified some housing actions that we haven't yet implemented. So we put all of those together in an action catalog. There's about 150 actions. Not all of them are actions that can be taken at the regional level, but we wanted to have them in one place as a starting point so that we could start honing in on the actions that are most appropriate for TRPA. So that action catalog is on our website. And then the other tool that we introduced, and we'd actually shown this tool to the governing board previously, is a housing cost analysis tool. And Alyssa's going to go over how we applied that to the actions in more detail, but basically that helped us analyze the actions to determine which could result in the greatest cost reduction benefit to the overall cost of housing. And so I talked about that the working group confirmed what that housing need is that we're working toward. And there's a couple of two tiers of housing need that we're looking at as the working group. So one is California requirements for California jurisdictions. So California jurisdictions are required to meet the regional housing needs assessment requirements. And that's basin-wide on the California side, that's about 1,000 units over the next 8 years. But the Tahoe Prosperity Center in Placer County actually did more in-depth Tahoe-specific analysis to look at all of the workforce housing need across all income levels. And they identified that need as really more around 4,000 units. In meeting that need, local partners have been making significant progress over the last year and the last several months. So we're actually seeing about seven projects that have either already been submitted for, they've already submitted permit applications or they're about to submit a permit application. And that will result in about 600 deed-restricted units. Most of them are deed-restricted affordable with some form of public subsidy, like a public land donation. There's about 70 that are deed-restricted achievable and 3 that are going to be deed-restricted moderate. So these units that we're seeing come in, we're actually really seeing these take advantage of the workforce housing or the housing incentives that were built into the 2012 regional plan and were expanded upon with the Development Rights Strategic Initiative in 2018. And the exciting thing about having these projects be coming through the permitting process concurrent with the work of the Tahoe Living Working Group is that we can identify where these projects are really able to use the incentives that are built into the plan and where they still need additional modifications in order to pencil. So we've actually been able to take the lessons learned from these projects in real time, and we've incorporated many of those lessons learned into the package of recommendations that we're going to be presenting to you today. So the working group met again in November, and at that meeting, we really honed in on what are the key priority actions for TRPA to take that we want to prioritize and then recommend moving forward on. So we talked about that action catalog with the 150 actions. We really wanted to narrow that down to manageable actions. So in preparation for this meeting, TRPA staff met with the staffs of the 5 local jurisdictions, and we also met with two workforce housing developers who work in Lake Tahoe. One is Mia Kong. She is leading this Sugar Pine Village development, and she really focuses on deed-restricted, subsidized, affordable housing developments. We also met with a developer who works in South Shore who does more moderate income market rate development. That's more the type of development that you saw Tony presenting in his presentation. So through those conversations, we were really able to identify some of the main things that are preventing local jurisdictions and those developers from using the existing incentives that are built into the code and from kind of meeting their own workforce housing goals. And I want to just highlight some of the main themes that led us to these eight basic kind of actions that we're recommending. One of the big themes that came through is that tourist and large kind of single family homes that end up being second homes, they have a lot easier time. They're still much easier to build than those smaller attached workforce units that we might see as part of a mixed use development in a town center or might go into a multifamily zone. Those workforce units are still facing more barriers in permitting. So there's more hurdles through permitting, particularly if they're deed restricted, and there's more uncertainty that they face. And density is another issue. So the densities, they definitely advantage tourist units and they disadvantage residential units. So that was a key finding that helped us shape these recommendations. Another thing that we heard is that the California jurisdictions are very much keying in on using accessory dwelling units as a way to meet their moderate income RENA requirements. So you saw in the last slide that we're actually having quite a bit of success at getting deed restricted affordable on the ground, and we're even going to see some achievable units come in. But those moderate income, not middle income housing, is still some of the hardest to provide. Finally, we also heard that the coverage incentives that are built into the regional plan to encourage development in town centers are working well. And again, we're seeing that with some of these projects that are coming through. And the working group members in the local jurisdictions wondered if some of those coverage incentives could also be applied to workforce housing outside of centers to incentivize workforce housing in other places. So that's what we want to look at as well. So I'm not going to go over each of these, but those are kind of the main themes that really shaped these. And we also found that these main actions that we were able to hone in on kind of fell into two categories. So on the left, these are actions where we will need to look at changing regulations to incentivize certain land use types. These are more organized based around land use types, whereas the actions on the right, we would look at changes to policies that are more general and might apply to multiple land use types. And Alyssa will explain that more. So now I'm going to turn it over to Alyssa, and she's going to explain the process that we went through to prioritize these actions.
Thank you, Karen. Right, so in order to really hone in on these actions and figure out what their level of impact could be, we developed the housing cost analysis tool, which is shown on this slide here. And we did this because oftentimes when we're talking about housing in Tahoe, we hear that the cost to build is very high. And so this tool helps us to understand which actions would have the highest cost reductions. And so when we started developing this tool, we looked at five different housing types, which are seen on kind of the x-axis. And then we looked at the various cost components like land and construction, which are shown in the various colors within those five bars. And I won't get into the specific results of the analysis today. You can see that on the left-hand side of the slide, there's different boxes that you can check to look at the various impacts of the actions. And this really helped us look at the level of impact that that we could have to the cost of development to get it closer to what locals can afford. Next slide, please.
Sorry. For some reason, sometimes I have trouble going to the next. Can you see the next slide now?
Yeah, thank you. And so in addition to the cost and affordability, which is the third one, the housing cost and analysis tool, we also looked at the alignment with local jurisdiction actions, as Karen mentioned. So we met with all the local jurisdictions to hear their priorities. And then last, we looked at the number of units that could potentially result from each action. So to the extent we could, we wanted to numerically look at how many units could result from specific actions. And we felt like this, these three evaluation criteria gave us a broad idea of the level of impact that the actions could have. Next slide, please. And this slide and the next slide are the results of that evaluation. And just to reiterate what Karen said, we have split these actions into two groups, although we'll have to look at both of them kind of together because they all influence one another. This slide is showing the land use actions, and it is really focused on what can be built, while the policy actions help to remove the barriers and can help incentivize those types of land use. First is the ADUs, as Karen mentioned. Four of the jurisdictions view ADUs as a priority and anticipate that ADUs could provide a significant amount of units in that moderate and workforce housing income level. Mixed-use residential was identified by three jurisdictions as a priority. And mixed-use development really contributes to those thriving centers that Tony talked about. I think one of his first slides showed a walkable community near Sprouts in South Lake Tahoe. And that's really what we want to see, but it would be great to have some more residential units in that same area. And so right now, mixed-use residential development is actually disincentivized because of the density and coverage requirements. So we'll be looking at how we can better focus our efforts on making that more feasible. Tourist and commercial conversions. Right now, we know that a lot of our locals are actually living in tourist units. But again, due to our density requirements, it's incentivized to convert from a tourist or a commercial use to a residential use. So again, we'll be looking at how we can make this more feasible in our areas that are zoned multifamily and in our town centers. And then last, land donations. This already happens quite a bit with our larger multifamily housing developments that go in and was listed as a priority by two jurisdictions. This isn't an action that TRPA would directly take on as we don't own any land, but we definitely want to continue to work with our local jurisdiction and land bank partners to make it more feasible. Next slide, please. And this slide shows the policy actions. So again, these policy actions help make the land use actions more feasible. And just to give a quick example, it's hard to look at ADUs without looking at coverage. So again, we're going to have to sort of look at all of these actions holistically while trying to prioritize a few. And so first is density. Going back to Tony's presentation, density is very important. And so we'll be looking at how we can increase our residential density where appropriate, particularly in areas that are zoned already for multifamily or within our town centers or within a certain distance from our town centers. Density has the potential for a pretty significant cost reduction. This analysis, we assumed that a higher density development would have smaller units and reduced parking amounts in order to fit the larger number of units. Permitting improvements and streamlining, we are hearing from our developer contacts that there are still some barriers for building our workforce housing, specifically barriers for deed restricted units and additional hearings. And so we'll focus on how we can improve our permitting and make it easier for our developers so they have more predictability and certainty when they're trying to build. allowing for more flexible coverage requirements was identified by three jurisdictions as a priority. And so we'll be looking at how we can expand the flexible standards that we already have in our town centers to other appropriate areas. And then lastly, fees. We already waive our application fees for deed-restricted units. And so we've heard from our partners that impact fees are still an issue, but they're rather minimal in comparison to all of the other costs. So we've ranked this as a bit lower, but we will continue to look at our impact fees within other projects. And with that, I will hand it back to Karen to talk about the priorities and next steps.
Great, thanks, Alyssa. So, so Alyssa really described these different actions that we're proposing. And she explained kind of why we put some in the near term, the ones that were ranked higher for complementing local jurisdiction work or getting, you know, larger cost reductions, we moved up in the process. So those are the ones that are in the near term recommendations. And then the others, you know, we put in medium term and longer term. One of the really important things for us is to break this into manageable pieces. So that is why we are only proposing to work on two issues at a time. And the first two are, you know, focusing on looking at ways to further incentivize ADUs and small homes and revisiting our densities in town centers and multifamily areas. So we anticipate that we would, you know, start working on the near-term priorities in February and anticipate that we might be bringing code changes to the governing, to the local government and housing committee and the governing board within 3 to 6 months. After that, we would move on to the medium term and start looking at ways to further incentivize mixed-use residential development and, again, look at that permitting parity. So how can we make it, you know, as easy to get a workforce development or workforce home permitted as it is to get one of these larger second homes permitted? And then if we still need to, after that, we would come back and look if to see if there are remaining incentives needed to further incentivize tourist and commercial conversion to residential and those public land donations. And coverage and fees, you heard, are very important. We think those are a little more challenging and they have a smaller cost benefit overall. So we're keeping these a little bit later in the prioritization scheme. But I did want to note, and Alyssa mentioned this too, particularly for tourist and commercial conversion to residential, one of the key barriers to this is related to density. So we may actually get at quite a bit of this last tourist conversion item here while we're talking about density. And the same with coverage. We want to look at whether we can use coverage incentives to help incentivize the use of ADUs and smaller homes as workforce housing. So some of that will come up in those first items. So basically at this point, I want to turn it back over to Sue to lead questions and input, and we're happy to answer any questions or go into any more detail on any of these, the prioritization scheme or the individual actions. And then after this, we have a slide for a motion.
Great. Thank you, Karen, and thank you for the presentation. That was really great. A lot of great information and some interesting thought-provoking ways we can start this process. Of course, for me, I've always liked to said, let's get it all done, but that doesn't work that way. It just doesn't work that way. But at any rate, so this is great. I'm looking at my panelists first to see if there's questions. If there's any questions, please raise your hand, and we'll get started with that. I'm not seeing any hands yet, but I'll give the panelists. John Frederick. Hi, John. Go ahead and unmute yourself. You should be able.
Yep.
There you go.
Hi.
How you doing?
All right, great. Thank you.
Good.
Thanks, Karen, for the overview, and you know, definitely the city of South Lake Tahoe is very supportive of this of all these approaches, but you know, and particularly excited about the near term possibilities with ADUs. I know you mentioned 3 to 6 months, so I guess a question would be, I mean, an interest of the city would be to be able to permit ADU construction this, you know, as soon as possible at the beginning of this construction season. So more in the 3-month timeline, and also to allow them to be some to be built as market rate units, but just by their nature, they're small and affordable. So just, I guess a question is, what do you see as what hurdles we need to overcome to do them on the short side of that 3 to 6 month time frame, so that we can have some of these, you know, going on in the ground, you know, this summer?
Yeah, I definitely think that one of the first tasks of the working group in February is to identify which elements of these actions are widely supported and could potentially move forward more quickly. So, you know, we're definitely planning in a buffer of 3 to 6 months. You know, you heard some of the things that Tony was presenting in his presentation related to looking at density. Those may be things that we want to take a little longer time to do a good job on, and we might even need to push some things related to that into a longer term time frame. But I definitely think that there are some incentives and things that we can do related to ADUs in particular that could happen quickly. So I think that will be the task of the working group, to really identify which of those things that there's broad support for, and figure out what time frame we want to move individual pieces forward on. And I just also want to mention on ADUs, we do already have built into our code a local government housing program that local governments can opt into, and then they are able to build ADUs on parcels of less than 1 acre if they work with TRPA to pass a resolution allowing that, and Placer County has taken advantage of that. However, all three of the California jurisdictions have indicated that the program as it is currently exists is too restrictive. Like, it's not enough to actually incentivize people to build accessory dwelling units, and Placer County has experienced that. They've had that program in place for 3 years and they've only received one application. So I think there's a lot of options for looking at ways to expand that existing program so that jurisdictions can still opt in, but just maybe look at making the incentives a little bit stronger.
Very good. Thank you, John. On to Jim Lawrence. Jim? I think you need to unmute yourself. There we go.
Thanks, Sue. Appreciate it. And thanks again, Karen and Lisa. Great presentations. I think the way you've laid it out, and certainly given our capacity issues, it does make sense. We can't, you know, take on too much and still make progress. The permitting box gives me a little bit of pause. When I look at that box, I almost break it up into three different categories. You know, I think of permitting as, you know, one is streamlining, given all of the rules, you know, how do we make the process go quicker? And streamlining is one thing. The other is, are there rules in place that just, you know, make it prohibitive for these activities to occur? And then the last bucket is, you know, what has been raised, I'm not sure I really fully understand it, and it's the parity issue. You know, to me, that's, I look at that differently than streamlining, or even are there rules that are inhibiting this. You know, having rules in place that basically are applied evenly or fairly across different land use categories, you know, something I think we should always strive for. And I'm wondering, particularly given Tahoe being largely a tourist economy, if we don't address that parity issue between tourism uses and workforce housing issues, are we going to be missing opportunities in the short term? And I'm basically kind of throwing out there, is there low-hanging fruit in the parity bucket that we as an agency can take on that might be more helpful to getting some of these projects on the ground? I would hate to have low-hanging fruit regarding parity kind of wait 9 months if that's something that we can easily address in the short term.
Yeah, I really appreciate that comment. One example of the permitting parity issues that we've identified is that, you know, if you have four or more deed-restricted units, there's additional hearing requirements. And if they're market rate units, they don't have those requirements. So those may be things that potentially, maybe at that first working group meeting, we can find a way to identify some of those things, maybe even in advance with some of the working group members, where there's things that seem like low-hanging fruit and see if we want to move them up. I think we should, I would recommend still kind of orienting on these main categories just so that we have something to organize our work, because one of the big challenges with housing is everything is very interconnected and it's really hard to decide where to start. So I think in some ways we need a place to start, we need to get going. And then if we feel that there is something additional that we can add in and it won't, you know, slow us down too much, I think that's fine to entertain that that within a framework.
Thanks, Karen. I appreciate that. And, you know, certainly, yeah, it's very complicated. Everything's sort of interrelated. You know, the Basin's been working on this for many years, and there's no magic answer. So I certainly appreciate your answer there, Karen. But I do appreciate the offer that, you know, as we get into the working group meetings, if there is, like, just easy low-hanging fruit in some of these other kind of buckets, and again, I'm thinking permitting parity, to not just wait for a year to tackle that just because it's in that box.
Yeah, and actually in a way that is how we structured this. You know, when we look at ADUs and small homes, we're going to look at permitting related to ADUs and small homes, and we're gonna look at coverage related to ADUs and small homes. So that will be one place where we can start looking at it.
Great, thanks.
Very good, thank you, Jim. So I don't see any other committee members with their hands up. So I'll move over to the attendees. Ronald Yank, I think you are unmuted if you'd like to ask a question.
Is he unmuted or to one of the...
Yeah, he needs to unmute. I'm sorry. He was unmuted, I thought.
How about that?
There you go. Thank you. Okay. All right, go ahead, Ronald.
On ADUs, I could see a second homeowner decide to build an ADU so that other members of the family can have a bigger get-together in the summer. Is there any reason that any of our partners, the city of South Lake Tahoe, Incline Village, whatever, would not want to limit ADUs to low-cost or workforce housing?
Okay, good question. Karen?
I mean, I think that's one of the things that we need to look at specifically in the ADU bucket. Right now, because of TRPA's growth system, so that type of thing is allowed right now on parcels of less than 1 acre. Someone can build an ADU and use it for their own guests. If we wanted to expand to allow ADUs to be allowed on parcels of less than 1 acre, if somebody wanted to build an ADU like that and use it as a guest house, they would need to get an allocation. So they'd either need to wait in line for an allocation, and they would also need to transfer in a potential unit of use. So that second home would be treated by our system like a full single family home. So that's for our growth management system. That's kind of how we would think of it. It's like, okay, if you want to do that, that's fine. But that's quite a hurdle to do. So number one, you know, maybe somebody wouldn't want to go through that just to build a guest house. Or if they do want to, then from, you know, TRPA would need to decide, are we okay with that? Because they are basically taking an allocation. So they're drawing down on our growth growth allocations. But the group might want to look at, yeah, maybe we can also really incentivize people to restrict those for workforce, because maybe we wouldn't offer some of these other incentives like coverage incentives unless they are deed restricting it for workforce housing. So I think those are the considerations that the group is going to need to look at.
Okay, very good. On to Jack Patton. Jack, I think we're going to unmute you here. Give us 1 minute. Let's try to unmute. There we are.
Okay.
Jack, there.
Yeah, thank you. This morning's been really helpful. It's especially in the basin, all of this is becomes a much bigger deal than in a more flat terrain, less nuanced environmentally. And so we're dealing with a lot of these issues. And one of the things we've talked a little bit, Karen, you and I just had a brief conversation about the 28-foot height envelope, or 28-foot plus or minus, because there is a sliding range based on slope of roof, outside the town center is limiting in terms of taking advantage of a density bonus or trying to even limit coverage, because coverage is such a big factor, then height becomes another compounding factor, when often there's project sites that are well suited to a third level, but the 28-foot envelope and the roof slope criteria combined, it just is very difficult to, it's nearly impossible to get a third level. So that's one of the things I'd like to have considered, as well as the town centers are fine. There's plenty of height envelope. And then one other thing that comes to mind in terms of the ADUs, and it's we've got a project in North Shore right now that we're looking at attached junior ADUs, which don't tend to have the coverage penalty or coverage issue, or often don't, where they can be under the existing coverage envelope or within the existing coverage envelope, especially when we have many sloping sites. They can be under floor space that could be fairly easily converted or designed in on new construction. So just two things to kind of put in to consideration is the height envelope restriction outside the town centers, and then thinking of not only ADUs, but attached junior ADUs. Thank you.
Thanks. So just to address the attached junior ADUs, and if I don't fully address your question, just ask again, but those attached junior ADUs are part of the California legislation that local California jurisdictions are required to allow. So the California jurisdictions have been putting in place their ADU regulations, and they do allow them. You know, now TRPA needs to look at ours to see where we can align, but that would be something that we could look at in that ADU action, making sure that those are accommodated if we want them. And then as far as the height question, yeah, that's a really good question. Kind of internally, in preparation for the working group meetings coming up starting in February, we started identifying which sub actions we would include as part of this. And one small height action that we wanted to include in the density discussion is making sure that modular housing can be allowed, because it is a little bit higher, it's like a foot higher, and sometimes it just slightly exceeds our density regulations. So the point of the density regulations is not to prevent probably like 1 foot of modular. So we want to make sure that we're addressing that. But as far as the height outside of the town centers, I think that that is the kind of thing that we would look at in the mixed use residential action, or the tourist commercial conversion to residential. Or if it is affecting small homes, then we would talk about it when we're talking about small homes. So I think we just need to make sure that we're talking about it as it relates to one of these actions on the left.
Very good. Thank you, Karen. Amanda Ross, you're up next. Give us a minute here.
Okay. Hi, everyone. Thank you so much. Thank you, Sue. Thank you, staff, for this presentation. This was really helpful. I had a couple of questions. So I'm excited to see ADUs as a near-term goal by TRPA. And I'm sorry, Karen, I missed the part of the presentation where you guys were discussing costs for ADUs. You had that cool slide where you looked at like how much it would cost for that versus other components. I was changing a diaper during that, so I missed that. But when you looked at that cost, did you include costs for having to potentially buy coverage? And I asked that because, you know, the fact that most lots in town that have excess coverage, you know, the cost for those lots go up if you're looking to buy a home that has excess coverage. If you want to purchase coverage to be able to build an ADU on your lot, that's very expensive, and there's lots of difficulty in trying to figure out, you know, what kind of coverage can you have on your lot, how much you can bring over. So, you know, personally, like my husband and I, we would love to build an ADU on our property that's workforce housing specific. Like, I know El Dorado County, that's where I live. They have a great sliding scale for how large the ADU could be based on the size of the lot. And unfortunately, you know, we don't own a 1 acre lot, as most, I think, middle income residents in the county can't afford that. So I just wanted to make sure that the TRP is looking at opportunities and ways to make ADUs affordable for people who are not the wealthiest of our community to be able to have some small part of making more workforce housing available for the community. Because like I said, I would absolutely love to build an ADU on my property in the county. But the coverage costs really make it prohibitive for us to be able to do that. Thank you.
Yes, thanks, Amanda. We did include the cost of coverage in the ADU cost estimate, and we are still showing that it costs still quite a bit to build an ADU. So that is one reason that we want to look at coverage incentives in that action.
Okay, very good. I don't see any more hands raised per se. We do have some questions in the Q&A part. Did you want to try to answer some of those, Karen? I know I see one here from Bill Yates. What happens when we have a good project come forward like Sugar Pine Village that requires regional plan changes?
Yeah, that's a great question. So the governing board has been seeing quite a few area plan amendments come through with these projects, because even though they're able to use our regional plan incentives, there's still just a few things that don't quite work that we've been bringing forward and getting support from the governing board for modifying through area plan recommendations. At this point, as these projects come through, our only mechanism, if they don't, if they can't pencil with our current code or with the current area plan, our main mechanism is really to do an area plan amendment. So that's why we are trying to actively watch these projects, and where there's a change that seems like it would be applicable basin-wide, we're gonna look at those through the working group. So just one example of that, the Sugar Pine Village project is a mixed-use project. It's residential and public service. We found that in our code, mixed-use projects are not allowed to transfer in soft or potential coverage. They can only transfer in hard coverage. So even though a residential project or a public service project could transfer in soft or potential project, when they got mixed together, they couldn't. So that required an area plan amendment. And I think that's the kind of thing that we would want to be looking at with the working group. Granted, that would be in the second tier. So maybe that's, you know, one of the things that we'd want to consider if that's going to apply enough that we might want to move that up.
Thank you. Another question, would you consider an ADU for multi-generational family housing to be similar use to workforce housing?
I'm assuming, okay, so maybe Jill is talking about like someone who's retired who's not actually working. Yeah, I think that's definitely a consideration. That's a use that people find very helpful with ADUs, of having people at different ages in their family being able to, you know, one moves into the ADU and one moves into the larger property. So I think that's something that we need to look into when we discuss the incentives.
I don't know if you see anything else there you want to ask, answer rather, Karen, at this point. I'm not sure of our time yet, but how we're doing. But if there's any other discussion, otherwise I'll be bringing it back to our committee for action here.
I don't see, okay, wait, I'm sorry, I have to read these questions a little bit. I don't see any other questions that are jumping out at me that look like they directly apply to this agenda item, but if a member of the public wants to raise their hand and ask their question, if I'm missing it, that would be great.
Yeah, I'm not really seeing much either. And I don't see any other hands raised. I'll give them a few seconds more. And if not, I do not see any. So I think I'm going to bring this back to our committee. So we our staff is asking us for an affirmative vote for the majority of the quorum to allow our staff to move forward with a with direction on this priority housing action for the Tahoe Living Housing and Community Group. So I'm not sure. Do we have, Karen, do you have a suggested motion as we sometimes get in there? I don't know if you have a slide.
We don't have, let's see. We wanted to leave it open. So okay. We have a specific motion, but I think we could make a motion to recommend the priority action framework as presented to the governing board for approval.
Okay. All right, is there anyone, I lost my screen here. Is there anyone like to make that motion? If so, please go ahead and unmute yourself as far as our committee members, and I will entertain that motion.
Thanks, Sue. I'll make that motion. Cindy Gustafson.
Thank you, Cindy. Do we need a second on that? I'm trying to remember on this one. Probably don't. okay. great. So what I'd like to do, is there any other discussion from the committee members?
Sue, this is Belinda. I just want to echo comments that have been made by others that this is a fantastic set of presentations and recommendations that we've heard. I really appreciate the fact that we were given a very, very easy to understand framework for moving this forward. And just want to extend my congratulations to all the staff and everyone who's participated in the development of this. I think it's phenomenal that so many cities are coming together to address this issue collectively. And that's, in the county, obviously, as well. I think it's the way that we need to start doing better regional planning for sure. So I want to just say that up there.
Thank you, Belinda. I really appreciate those comments, and I do also want to echo those comments and that TRPA staff's done an excellent job. It's something that all of our local jurisdictions have been not just even having pressure to want to develop, but understanding it's an incredible need for our workforce and for our citizens of our jurisdictions that just a real need to get affordable middle-income housing going. So very excited about this, and I think this is all coming together at a perfect time, and so I really do thank you for this. So with that, we have a motion, and so I'd like to get a roll call on the motion, please. I think we'd need to pass this over to Catherine to actually do a roll call. Is Catherine there? I'm sorry.
Just checking, make sure that Catherine is not muted. Catherine.
It's going back and forth, so there may be an issue there.
Let's see, Catherine, are you there? If not, maybe I can read the roll call.
If you don't mind, if you have the...
I think she's trying to unmute. I see her muting and unmuting.
Okay.
Wait a moment.
Sure, we'll give it a minute here. Sure, not a problem.
All right, it seems like Catherine is having difficulty.
Okay, do you have the roll there? I just don't have the exact roll here, otherwise I would do that. Oh, it says not sure. Yeah, she is having difficulty.
Okay. Let's see. Alyssa, would you mind, while I call the roll from the list I have on screen, would you mind pulling up the list that I sent you the other day? And if I miss, then you can read anyone that I miss.
Yep, I can do that.
Okay, thanks. So, Belinda Faustinos?
Yes.
John Friedrich?
Yes.
Wesley Rice?
Yes.
Alexis Hill?
Yes.
Ovisel?
Yes.
Jim Lawrence?
Yes.
And did I call Cindy?
No, but I'm going to vote yes.
Okay. Anybody else there, Karen? I think, did we get everyone, Karen?
I think I may be missing one person.
Let's see, we had John, right?
We have everyone who's here.
Okay.
I think Shelly dropped off, but she might be missing one.
Yep, Shelly did drop off. So I think we're good.
I think that's everybody.
Okay, great. So that motion passes. Thank you all. Appreciate your understanding that. All right. So with that, thank you. Very excited about that again. And so with that, we're going to go ahead and move on to item 4, which is committee member reports. So if there's any committee members that you would like to make any comments about, in particular today, housing and what's going on in your jurisdictions or areas of expertise, we'd love to hear it. So if you do have something, please just go ahead and raise your hand right now, and I will call on you. And I am not seeing anybody at the – oh, Cindy. Yes, please, Cindy Gustafson.
Well, thanks, Sue, but I see Wes madly raising his hand.
I'm sorry, and I don't have my.
He should go first. He beat me to it.
Thank you, Wes. I'm sorry. I don't. I only have so many little screens I'm seeing. So I apologize.
Trust me, I understand. You're about a quarter of an inch tall.
Right. Exactly. Which I like. Wide, so. Thank you.
I just wanted to say that at our last meeting of our Board of Commissioners, there was a couple of folks who wanted to take a couple of my committees from me, who happened to not be friends of the lake, if you know what I mean. And I'm happy to say that I was able to retain all of my committees and commissions, and you're stuck with me for another 2 years.
Love it. I wouldn't say step, Wesley. Very happy to have you along, Wes.
Thank you.
And congratulations. Appreciate that. Okay, Cindy.
Sure. Thank you. I just wanted to report on a number of things Placer County took action on at our December 15th meeting to close out 2020. One is approving our draft housing element of the Placer County plan for 2021 through 2029. And that is, I don't know if it's been submitted yet, but it will go into the state for a 60-day review period and be moving forward. And of course, incorporates many of the issues we're talking about today. We also approved our Tahoe Basin Area Plan housing related amendments. And those address ADUs and consistency with TRPA language. That'll be coming to the governing board this month for action. And finally, maybe most exciting to me is the formation of the Tourism Business Improvement District by the business associations, which once it moves through the whole formation process will free up a dedicated stream of transient occupancy tax funding for housing and transportation, which are so critical to successful implementation of our goals for the regional plan. And then moving forward, we are still working on that Dollar Creek crossing site and looking at some mixed use of housing types, and in some of the discussions that we saw from Opticus today, I think are right in line with what we've been talking about for some portion of that property. And also looking at a second round of amendments to our Tahoe Basin Area Plan, targeting some of the economic sustainability needs in the town centers, working with BAE Urban Economics to move those efforts forward. And then launching this spring our Workforce Housing Preservation Program, which is purchasing the deed restrictions that, similar to Vail, Colorado, on existing housing, allowing that middle-income group, missing middle, to buy in and actually purchase homes with offsetting funding from the freed up TOT that we're talking about, as well as other sources. And then we're in pre-development on the Tahoe Inn project just across the state line up in Kings Beach for a housing project there with JMA Ventures. So really exciting, a lot of movement happening in housing. You know, we've made so much progress and staff has been doing a tremendous amount of work to bring these programs forward. And I know they're listening in. I just want to give kudos to them for really taking this and moving forward with TRPA staff to make these projects happen.
Thank you, Cindy. Wow, what a great report. I'm very excited to hear that. And if there's anything you want to share with the committee as far as how you get there and how it goes, please do share, because that's great. Great to hear. And all of us other jurisdictions, you know, are trying to follow along, and we really appreciate hearing about that. So do I hear, I don't see any other hands up. I will just say, as similar to Wes, is that I have a new alternate to TRPA, and very excited that our city councilwoman from our former city councilwoman to Placerville, Wendy Thomas, has been approved to be my alternate to all things Tahoe. And so that's great, because she gives a great city perspective, and she's very interested. She was online for the presentation today, because she's very interested in this missing middle project, and really wants to move forward on that within our county. So very excited. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and go on to public interest comments, item number 5. I'm sorry. Was there somebody else?
John.
Oh, yeah, please.
All right, good. I just want to give a quick report. We did discuss at our city council meeting, South Lake Tahoe City Council yesterday, housing for a bit of time. And we're looking at a number of things, including a rental assistance with the eviction moratorium deadline looming, to make sure we don't have folks that are being pushed out with no options. We're looking at an incentive program for a second home and vacation rental conversions to long-term rental, whether it's a landing locals approach that has been piloted in Truckee or working with our Tahoe Home Connection or some combination therein. And also just wanted to note that the high school here, Career and Technical Education track, is looking at doing some training with high school students in that strong workforce program on building tiny homes and ADUs, just to kind of prepare a workforce for this. So there's discussion with Western Nevada College construction program about doing some workforce development to train a local workforce to build ADUs. So just additional benefits to pursuing this kind of housing is, I think it also means local job opportunities, and those are being I said cultivated both at the high school and community level. That's what I have.
Great, thank you so much, John. I appreciate that. I do want to kind of piggyback on there and let you know, because I am on the executive committee for CSAC, the California Association of Counties, that the governor is planning on asking immediate action from the legislature in California to extend the eviction moratorium. So that's good news. So hopefully we'll get that extended so that locally it's not such an issue for us. But I appreciate that update. Okay, anyone else I'm missing here? I apologize if I do. I'm not seeing any other hands raised. If everyone wants to unmute, if they want have anything else, otherwise, I'm going to go ahead and, all right, I'll move on to public interest comments. If any member of the public wishes to address the local government and housing committee on an item not on the agenda, please raise your hand now in Zoom to be unmuted by TRPA staff. If you're calling in and wish to address the committee, please dial *9. So we'll give everybody a minute or two. Yes, we have Steve Teixeira here online who would like to speak.
Let me see if I hang on. All right, I am.
Thank you, Chair Novosel and members of the committee, and thank you for the presentations and the meetings. I had a couple of just a process question for Karen. I'm speaking today on behalf of Tahoe Chamber, and at Tahoe Chamber we're contemplating setting up a board committee on housing issues. So first question, Madam Chair, if I might ask directly to Karen, Our meetings of the Tahoe Living Working Group, are those open to the public as well?
Yes, okay. They are.
Like these meetings. And are you keeping track of who's attending, and are you building on that list, or do people need to register each time for the meetings? How does that work?
Yeah, so actually, thanks for asking that question. We do have a mailing list that we send out, we maintain for anybody who wants to know about the meetings, and we send out an email like about a week or 2 weeks ahead of each meeting to let people know. So you should be on that list. One of the problems with the list is that it comes out from an email consolidator, so sometimes it goes to people's spam folders and they don't see it. So if that's happening to you, please let me know, and I have a separate list and I'll send you an announcement directly from my email. So if anybody wants to join the list, definitely send me an email and I'll add you, and then we can also just make sure that you're actually getting the emails.
And second question, Karen, so if I wanted to add, if we form this board committee on housing, and I want to add names, I can contact you and you could add those names for both the living working group as well as this committee. Is
yeah.
that right?
Yeah.
Okay. I appreciate that clarity. I think this is important work, and we're trying to get some of our board members to be engaged in some of these detailed presentations so they have a broader understanding of when we take matters to the full board to take positions on these issues, there's more of an understanding on the part of the board. So thank you very much. And we'd like to welcome Commissioner Alexis Hill to TRPA and TDD. Nice to see you, Alexis. So thank you all very much. And we're excited to be moving forward on many of these important issues. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. And thank you for your continued work. Yes, please.
I want to add to Karen's answer to Steve. Steve will recall when he was chair of the APC, it's an APC working group that has other people invited to participate. So it's the same format that you're used to, Steve. So please bring whoever's interested. The APC, Brendan as chair, welcomes everybody else. Of course, they're virtual right now, but it works the same way that the other APC working groups have. So I think you're very familiar with that.
Okay. Thank you for the clarification, John. Appreciate it. Okay, any other public interest comments? If you do, please go ahead and raise your hand. I'm not seeing any, but I'll give everybody another minute in case people are missing their buttons. This is public interest comment time. Okay, seeing none, I'm going to go ahead and close public comment. And I'm going to call for a motion to adjourn. I just want to thank our staff. This is a great first step. I really appreciate the collaboration between our local government agency and that of TRPA staff and moving it forward, because you know it goes through these different committees and all. We'll end up with a governing board, but this is a wonderful way to start, I feel. That we can start at the local level and move it through the committees and then get to the governing board. Just another excellent way of getting the communication and collaboration working. So really appreciate all that work. Thank you, Karen, in particular, and the entire staff.
Yeah, and we really appreciate this committee hearing the item and giving your feedback.
Thank you. Thank you again. All right. Do I hear a motion to adjourn?
So moved.
Thank you. Thank you, Belinda. So with that, we are adjourned. Thank you all, and we look forward to getting together and seeing everybody at the governing board meeting. Thanks again, everyone.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Take care,
thank
everyone.
Thank you. Bye.
Stay safe out there.
Always. Take care, Sue. Good to
thank
see you.
You too, Wes. Take care.